Group meeting, Sunday, 27th July, 1986. We are coming now to the end of Chapter 4, which is the injunction and the mandate. The injunction is not to impart esoteric knowledge to anyone who is not fit. The fitness consisted in those days mainly of devotion to truth, to the religious life, and they had to go through a period of discipline which proved that they were fit. Now there is one sentence here, two sentences in fact. You remember how Jesus said, "Suffer the little children to come unto me, for of such is the kingdom of heaven." When I was a little boy, I always wondered why the little children should have to suffer. Till I was informed that the word suffer meant allow. Now, Yajnavalkya, who was known as the Prince of Yogis, somewhere around the 7th or 8th century BC, this is one of the things he said: "Let a Brahman, having shaken free of the burden of book knowledge, choose to live as a child. When he becomes free of both learning and childlikeness, he becomes the silent one." Shaking free of both sound and silence, he becomes a Brahman. Now this needs just a little bit of explanation. We all understand, having shaken free of the burden of book learning. Learning, of course, is essential for ordinary everyday life. We couldn't do without it. But learning has one serious disadvantage. It conditions the mind. And we are taught to think, to interpret the spoken or the written word just in this, that, or the other way. And the person who teaches us to do that is himself possessed of a conditioned mind. So the mind isn't absolutely free to see the truth in its own light. So having shaken free of the burden of book knowledge, choose to live as a child. Now, what is one of the outstanding characteristics of a child? A child is innocent. Innocent in the sense of not guilty, but in the sense of being harmless, innocuous. That is the state of the child, the harmless state. And unless one can realize the harmless state, it is impossible to live the religious life in the true sense of the word. Then Yajnavalkya goes on, when he becomes free of both learning and childlikeness, he becomes the silent one. Now what is this silence that he realizes? In the ordinary way, our brain is constantly talking back at every single impression we receive through our senses, or at what we hear somebody speak, or what is written in a book. All the time, everyone's brain is talking back at it, non-stop. The only time when the brain stops talking is in deep, dreamless slumber. And it is in that state that the recuperation of the body really takes place, in the state of deep, dreamless slumber. Because no energy is wasted, there is no subservience to one's desires or to one's anxieties or daily problems. All that has gone to sleep. And therefore, the body recuperates most successfully in deep, dreamless slumber. And those of you who do yoga, you know how it is taught that there are the three states, what is called the ordinary waking state, in which, of course, we are awake to the life around us, to all our sense impressions, and so on. Then there is the dreaming state. What produces the dreaming state? The unresolved problems and so on of the waking life, the daily waking life, that leads to our dreams, besides other influences too. And then when all that quietens down, there is the third state. The first is the Jagrat, as it is called. The second is the Swapna, meaning a dream, Swapna. The third is the Sushupti, which is the silent state. And there is a fourth state, the Turiya state, which literally means the fourth state, in which you realize the silence whilst wholly conscious, fully conscious. So, how are you conscious? In the first three states, the waking, the dreaming state, and the dreamless slumber state, you are unconscious of the transcendent reality. The dreamless sleeping state recuperates the body, but because we experience it almost every day of our lives, our unconsciousness in that state prevents us realizing the benefits of that state when we wake up. But the Turiya state is one in which the yogi, the one who is capable of really entering the meditative state, experiences transcendent consciousness, the holistic consciousness. So now, free of both learning and childlikeness, he becomes the silent one. Shaking free of both sound and silence. The word sound is used to indicate what instruction one is given by one's teacher. The word Brahman, referring to a member of the caste known as Brahman, is almost identical with Brahman, which is the absolute ultimate reality. That was the word they used for the ultimate reality. When they sought to understand something of the nature of that absolute ultimate reality, by asking the question, what is this ultimate reality? When they ask the question, who am I, what am I? They came to the same conclusion, but they called it the Atma. The Atma, the word Atma is the subjective personal term. The word Brahman is the objective impersonal term. But impersonal in the sense of that which transcends personality. It's transpersonal, because it includes all personalities. So it's a transpersonal term. It's not an impersonal term in the sense in which those who are keen on theistic religions say that Brahman is something bloodless. Well, it is bloodless in the physical sense, but it is the totality in the transcendent sense. So now, he who has realized Brahman is the person who is called a Brahman. You see, in Sanskrit, I'm just trying to remember an actual example. You have a name, like Jabala, the sage Jabala. His mother was Jabala, and whoever is the child of a person whose name starts with the there are consonant vowel with the vowel in the first syllable, ja. The child of somebody whose name is ja something is ja that. So Brahman, B-R-A-H, whatever is derived from that is Brahman. You get it? That is the way to understand the meanings of these names. So, shaking free of both sound and silence, he becomes a Brahman. And this is really that transcendent Turiya state of complete holistic consciousness, which is the end point of the evolution of our human ordinary consciousness. Our ordinary consciousness is not holistic. It is a consciousness which is confined to the finite and the temporal only. That means, therefore, to the mortal. The holistic consciousness is not confined that way. It functions in terms of infinity and eternity. The yogi, in the real sense, realizes, that is, makes real, the actuality of infinity and eternity in clear consciousness. Now, this is something which a great many so-called yogis, professionals, are quite unaware. They don't know what it all means. And they assume all kinds of grand titles for themselves. I've got a book here which somebody had no more use for, gave it to me, and I haven't any special use for it. It's by His Divine Grace, somebody, something, something. Well, you know, all that sort of thing is just sheer nonsense and ridiculous. And to call oneself a Maharishi or a Mahayogi is really extraordinary conceit and downright cheek. Because Mahesh, for example, is the title of one of the titles of Shiva, the third person of the Trinity. How dare a human being just assume that title, go about the world making his living out of it? You see, these are the things we have to beware of. So now, this business about being as a little child was taught something like 7 or 8 centuries before the birth of Christ. Well, we have done with the injunctions. Let's come to the mandate. The great teachers, the founders of the religions particularly, did give this mandate to their disciples. Sri Krishna says to Arjuna, this comes in the Gita, the 18th chapter, or discourse, if you like to call it so, verses 68 and 69. He who shall declare this supreme secret among my devotees, having shown the highest devotion for me, that is the devotees who have shown the highest devotion, without doubt he shall come to me. Thank you. And Sri Krishna goes on to say, nor is there any among men who performeth dearer service to me than he, nor any shall be more beloved by me on earth than he. Now, I said yesterday at our meeting that it's rather a pity that the author of the Gita put those last few words, nor shall any be more beloved by me on earth. A father who is a true parent does not have degrees of love for his children. It's the same love. It's the total thing. To say that he loves a particular person more than anybody else is a drawback. And I'm sure that had there been a Sri Krishna in actuality, as an actual person, he would not have said these things if he had realized holistic consciousness. I say, if there was a Sri Krishna, I personally wonder whether there was a particular person called Sri Krishna. There probably was a particular prince called Arjuna, because these are historical facts. The father of Arjuna had five sons, and so on. But who was the author of the Gita? His name was Krishna Dvaipayana Veda Vyasa. His personal name was Krishna. My own feeling is, this is my own feeling, take it or leave it just as you think fit. This man who wrote the Gita was one who himself had realized transcendence. And the historical fact that there may have been a Krishna who was born in the western part of India, the place called Dwarka, and came and participated in that great war between the Pandavas and the Kauravas. There may have been one like that, but I feel so sure that it is the author of the Gita who uses the name Krishna to indicate his own realization of transcendence. And the author of the Gita, in his ordinary, normal, everyday state, where consciousness functions through the sense perceptions and the activity of the brain, he named Arjuna. So he's talking to himself. You know, you have this divine dialogue idea in all the great religions. Look at the Old Testament, and the angel of the Lord, or sometimes it's the Lord God himself, as in the case of Moses and Joseph. They speak personally, as they say. What does that mean? God is not a chap upstairs or downstairs or anywhere. God is the totality, the universal fact. And that totality doesn't speak any particular language that human beings speak. So, I think that this business of the divine dialogue means essentially that you yourself, realizing a very profound state, at least, if not the fully holistic state, so impress the organism in that state that later on, when the organism comes back to functioning exclusively in terms of the sense functions and the activity of the brain, you say, "The Lord said unto me," and so forth. I think that's far more reasonable and true to the facts. If you yourselves, I'm sure some of you at least, have experienced moments of illumination, of inspiration as we call it, but inspiration which is not the ordinary inspiration of an artist or whatever it is, but a truly spiritual illumination in consciousness, you will know that in that state you are entirely different from your ordinary everyday state. You see? Of course, it's easy to deceive oneself, and I was going to say, there are those who, out of ordinary egoism, self-esteem and self-conceit, claim that they have been in this transcendent state. I remember one example particularly in the 1950s. A Dutchman was quite convinced that God had so spoken to him and said this, that and the other. And what he gave out as the saying of God was, to use rather strong language, just piffling nonsense.
It was in Dutch, no doubt, was it? It was in Dutch, no doubt,
was it? No, he spoke in English.
Oh, but God spoke in Dutch.
Well, I suppose so. You see? These absurdities occur, and you have to be extremely careful, because these are subtle forms of selfness, spiritual pride, and so on, which is one of the great dangers one has to face. Now, Zarathustra said, "He who expounds to the wise." It's very interesting. In the Gathas, this comes again and again, to the wise. So it might imply not to anybody and everybody. "He who expounds to the wise the holy word is indeed blessed." The Buddha says to his first 60 perfected ones, this is during the first year of his ministry, "Walk, bhikkhus, on tour for the blessing of the many folk, for the happiness of the many folk, out of compassion for the world, for the welfare, for the blessing, the happiness of devas and men." And 40 years later, shortly, no, 45 years it ought to have been, 45 years later, shortly before his death, he says, "Therefore, because ye to whom the truths I have perceived have been made known by me, having thoroughly made yourselves masters of them, meditate upon them and spread them abroad in order that pure religion may last long and be perpetuated, in order that it may continue to be for the good and happiness of the great multitudes, out of pity for the world, to the good and gain and the weal of devas and men." And there are many things there. "Made yourselves masters of them," that needs no explanation. "Practice them," that is, live up to them constantly in your daily life, all day and every day. "Meditate upon them." Now, you remember, meditation is not musing or contemplation in the ordinary sense of the word. It's not even concentration upon a particular subject as such. Because all that sort of thing is just a verbal ritual. I don't mean to say don't continue with your verbal rituals. Do so and develop the power of concentrating your attention. It does do that, you see, and it can produce intellectual insights of quite a high order. But don't be deceived, self-deceived, that is meditation. When all that calms down and the brain is perfectly quiet and the whole organism is silent, is still, has realized its aloneness. Not aloneness in the sense of complete separation from the rest of the world, but in the sense of its unique individuality, its unique indivisibility. When it has realized that state, there comes the point when, through your actual meditation practice, all that will calm down and the brain will stop talking. Otherwise it will continue to talk. And that is not the actual meditative state. The meditative state is one in which consciousness, in the real sense of the word consciousness, is functioning in its own transcendent context. And in its own transcendent context, it doesn't talk. You know, well, this is one of the important things in Buddhism. We have the word vijnana as constituting part of, as the fifth constituent of the organism. Now, vijnana is discriminative consciousness. It is the consciousness which functions through the apparatus of the senses. So that is why we have in the very considerable analysis in Buddhism, eye consciousness, ear consciousness, tongue consciousness, etc. You see? That is, the sum total of that is vijnana. But all that stops. What sort of consciousness prevails thereafter? This is what the Upanishadic teachers termed the Atma. And the Buddha termed it with a long phrase, Vijnanam Anidasanam Anantam Sabbato Pabam. Consciousness which is characterless. It has no signs. You can't recognize it as you can, in the sense, in the way in which you can recognize a separate object or person or event or state of mind or condition. That is anidasanam. Anantam, endless. Whatsoever is endless is infinite, eternal. Bear that in mind when we talk about Buddhist teaching and we discard eternalism. It is eternal, endless. Anantam sabbato, everywhere, pabam, shining. That means enlightening, the enlightened state. What is the meaning of consciousness? Consciousness is knowingness. Whatever the ultimate reality is, call it God, call it Brahman, call it any name you like. It is conscious in this total sense. It is all-knowing. Those who realize these things, when they talked about God or Brahman, spoke about the omniscience of the transcendent. Now you see the meaning of omniscience. It doesn't mean that you are a marvelous encyclopedia of ordinary knowledge. Not at all. I'm sure that many of those great teachers themselves would have found it rather difficult to get through O level. But they got through a transcendent university. And so when they spoke from that transcendent level as the background of their consciousness. We have to remember that sort of thing. So much for meditate upon them and spread them abroad, etc. The Buddha says, pure religion may last long. What is pure religion? A set of doctrines, dogmas, rituals, beliefs? Not at all. The word religio is a very good, simple word. It comes from the Latin re ligare, which means to bind back. What is the definition of yoga? Yogas chitta vritti nirodha, says Patanjali. And what happens with the chitta vritti nirodha, the fluctuations of our ordinary worldly consciousness? They completely fade away. This new transcendent consciousness emerges as a result of that. So now, when that happens, what has happened to you, the individual being? You have realized your complete unity, your utter indivisibility in relation to the transcendent reality, to the totality, the one total reality, the absolute all. And that which relates you back to that, reinstates you in complete union with that, is religion. That is why in the previous chapter, I think, towards the end, I have put my own sort of feeling of what religion could mean. Whatsoever purifies the individual, awakens you to transcendence, and puts you into right relationship with the entire universe, is religion. That is religion. Once the systems of doctrines and dogmas and rituals come into being, it all gets garbled. It's like putting on clothes which are ill-fitting. Now, the living Jesus, the Son of Man, you know, whilst he was alive, he referred to himself as the Son of Man. Man and mind are both the same thing. The root is man. The Sanskrit root is man, from which the word man and the word mind are derived. And this root, man, has been defined in the dictionaries, the best of dictionaries, as to think. Now, you know, this is, well, of course, I mean, our dear scholars have never realized holistic consciousness, so they don't know what they are talking of when it comes to matters transcendent. To understand the meaning of the root man, study the Trismegistic writings. There is a wonderful statement in the second volume. There are three volumes. And then the statement goes, and then all Father mind, which is the way they refer to God, brought forth man co-equal to himself, with whom he fell in love because he was beautiful beyond compare, and on him did bestow all his faculties and powers. Now, further on, there is some explanation. This creative mind is the thought in the mind of God. Now, the mind of God is not one which talks any language like ours does. And they're going to say that that thought in the mind of God is the Logos, the creative word. So that is the real meaning of man, the root. And mind and man are derived from that, the Logos, the creative word. It is the primordial creative energy in action. That is what the word is. I don't know why I say all these things so positively. That's how it is. That's how I see it. So, the living Jesus, the Son of Man, says to his 12 apostles before sending them forth, "Go not into the way of the Gentiles, and into any city of the Samaritans enter ye not. But go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." You know the meaning of Israel? He who strives with God. And the word strives is usually interpreted as, when a wrestler strives with another person. And in the Old Testament, you have it presented that way. That God strove with, was it one to Joseph, whose name was changed to Israel? Yes, that's it, I think. But to strive with God means to work in cooperation with God as the servant. So that's what Israel means. Look up any good concordance to the Bible, you'll find the meanings of all these names there. "But go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, and as ye go, preach, saying, the kingdom of heaven is at hand." Some people translate it as "is within you." I think that that's really a better way of looking at it, not merely at hand. It is also at hand because the transcendent, the one reality, is the total thing everywhere here. Everything is the absolute concretized. We are a concretization of the primordial creative energy in the shape of living human beings. That brick wall made of bricks is a concretization in the shape of bricks. But the totality is God. That is why all the religions, theistic or non-theistic, have presented the total reality as being omnipresent. And yet who behaves in life as if he really was aware that that the transcendent is the omnipresent? If these people who raid banks and murder old men and women and so forth could be made aware that the transcendent reality is present all the time and it is embodied in them too. A Torquemada is transcendence embodied, functioning in that particular way. We can discuss that at some later date. Heal the sick, cleanse the lepers, raise the dead, cast out devils. Freely ye have received, freely give. Who gives freely? And what is to be given freely? The transcendent truth is what has to be given freely. Now, that is Jesus the Son of Man, the risen Christ, the Son of God. The Son of Man becomes the Son of God, remember. Says to the 11, the first is said to the 12, now it is said to the 11, Go ye into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. In a sense, Saint Francis preaching to the world, to the birds, is a fulfillment of this every creature. Preach the gospel to every creature. He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved, but he that believeth not shall be damned. Believeth. Does the word believe mean anything like its ordinary meaning as we use it in everyday life? Certainly doesn't mean that. I'm not sure of this because I haven't got an etymological dictionary with me, but I think the word belief, the word leaf, for example, is associated with the idea of complete faith, trust, and loyalty.